Karen O'Reilly joins us on the line now. Good afternoon, Karen. Where are you?
Good afternoon. I'm glad you asked, because here I am sitting in my little office in Essex, looking at a very cloudy sky.
Okay. I mentioned there, I don't know if you heard it down the line, that for your doctoral thesis, was that right? You spent 15 months on the Costa del Sol for that?
I did. I mean, that's going back to 1993 to 94. I came to the Costa del Sol for 15 months as a little PhD student, and spent all that time living amongst British people, living in Fringarola, Los Beliches. But I have to say, I've been back a lot of time over the years. I mean, many people have known me now for like 20, 25 years. Bought a house in Cartama eventually, which we've then sold. So I've been back many, many times. Quite long relationships now with people there.
Connection with you. If I think of you as David Attenborough, then I don't know what that makes us, right? Researching us.
Little ants.
ants. Okay, I'll take ant. I'll take ant.
Working hard.
Yeah, okay. All right. Maybe I'll be a drone bee then. That might be more appropriate for me.
Bee.
Yeah, Karen, I don't really know which angle to take on this, because as our listeners will know, we're talking about Brexit, banging on about it pretty much every day the last few weeks. People are afraid of the two terms, you know, the two words, customs union, and all of these sort of different things. From your perspective, how are things going at the moment? I mean, what's the main concern that you see for British citizens wanting to do business or work, live in the EU?
Do you mind if I start by just telling you a little bit about the project?
Do.
Because it's quite a big project that has been funded by UK in a Changing Europe, which is like an umbrella initiative that funds quite a lot of projects, independent projects, about EU-UK relations. So I think your listeners might quite enjoy hearing about that. You can learn a lot there just from them and from our website as well, which maybe you'll give out, I don't know. But our project is funded, unlike a lot of academic projects, it's funded for the whole duration of the negotiations. So it's a live project. So we're like, the idea is to tap into what's happening as things go along. And it's got three elements, really, to try to get to learn about people living in Europe so that we can inform policymakers, civil servants, experts, organisations, campaign groups about the populations, but also so that we can have our finger on the pulse as much as we possibly can, given that we're not lawyers or experts ourselves, as to what's going on. So our website, we try to say, look, this is the latest as far as we know it. But the main branch of it is to listen to and spend time with these different populations. You guys, basically, people who are living in Europe. We're quite a big team. Mainly Dr. Michaela Benson is the lead, and I'm working with her full-time. But we have other people working on doing different parts of the project. And we're doing case studies in France and Spain, but we have what we call a citizens panel. So we have people feeding into us across the whole of Europe. And then we're doing booster projects to really focus in on black and minority ethnic groups, because they're excluded very often from the story of British people abroad. And someone else looking at much younger people, because they often get excluded from the story of British people living abroad.
Things like the Erasmus project is a clear one where younger people would be affected by that.
Yeah.
Perhaps, you know, interrail travel. I noticed only recently the Commission is proposing basically giving every young person a month to travel around European countries. I think there would be like three or four you can visit, which British gap year students, for example, typically might be excluded from. I can understand the young people issue, but when you say black and other ethnic minorities, how are they different? What are the different issues compared to, say, the white population?
Well, I would certainly recommend you having a look at our website, which is brexitbritsabroad.com, and have a listen to Chantelle talking about her interviews there. is absolutely fascinating. It kind of almost takes me back to your first question, actually, because a lot of the people she's talking to are so busy dealing with everyday issues of racism and not feeling uncomfortable and not feeling integrated in certain societies that, you know, sort of Brexit and ongoing movement is less of an issue sometimes for some of these people. But, you know, in answer to your first question about, you know, what are the key issues that people are experiencing, I just wanted to say that for everyone, as soon as we started our project, you know, for all groups, the confusion, the frustration, the lack of information, the anxiety that we faced when we first started to talk to people was absolutely overwhelming. And I have to say, you must feel it yourself on the radio program. It comes like a tide, you know, maybe it recedes for a while when some new information comes out, but then it comes flooding back. And it can be quite painful sometimes to do some of these interviews because you're hearing stories from people that are having to deal with very, very real, difficult issues. Not everyone, of course. Of course, there are those who aren't very affected at all and, you know, very comfortable and very reassured. But, it's been very surprising to us, the diversity and complexity of experiences. That's why we wanted to include what we call people of colour, because, you know, what we're really interested in is to make sure that the messages we put across to government and policymakers is about the diversity of all the people who are living in Europe. You know, I was just at a meeting the other day and some people were sitting there and yet again said something like, but aren't they all rich and retired and just living in the sun and kind of why should we worry about them? And we still frustratingly get that kind of assumption.
Well, I can tell you, I'm sure you know, but tell our listeners, I have mentioned it on this program in the past, that in fact that is an understandable myth, but I can't remember the exact figure, but something like 2/3 of British citizens living in the European Union are in fact of working age.
Exactly.
So the pensioners are not actually the majority.
Yeah.
What's your plan with this project to compile this sort of personal, real human life experiences, real stories of the impact on real human beings, and then take it to whom? Presumably not to Brussels, because they don't need convincing. They say it wasn't our idea to leave the European Union. Is your plan to take this then to the cabinet in London?
We do whatever we can all the time. So it's not as if we're just waiting for a sort of final result, because people have asked us, you know, what are your findings? To be honest, we're producing things all the time so that when anything comes up, when there's any discussion going on anywhere, we can come in and we can say, have you seen this report? Have you seen this podcast? Have you seen these infographics that we've done? So, you know, our job is to try to find out when there are meetings, discussions, things like that, and to say to them, have you seen this, have you seen that, to put forward. So it's proactive in a way, to go to Parliament as well. So we've given evidence to the EU Justice Subcommittee. I'm just reading that now. To the EU Justice Subcommittee on the Issue of Citizens' Rights. In December, we submitted evidence. So any opportunity we can, we're submitting evidence, basically.
Well, you know, as you know, Guy Verhofstadt, who's the Brexit go-to guy for the European Parliament,
absolutely,
which, of course, is not negotiating, but will have the final vote on the EU side on any deal, if it's reached, of course. But he's very much the guy that we hear most, certainly from the EU institutions, speaking up for citizens' rights. And he really wants it to be as carte blanche as possible, as close to what we have right now. One concern that I have, and I doubt that I'm alone, is that in some documents it's in there, then it mysteriously disappears, then it's back in, and the latest is it disappears. And this is specifically the issue of the rights of British citizens who, for example, are resident in the EU now and have been for the qualifying period, and so won't lose that after Brexit, that their rights are specifically linked to the country they happen to be resident in now.
Yeah.
Rather than the right to freely move. If they're living and working in Germany now and decide they want to go and retire to Spain, they're stuck in Germany. How are we doing on that?
That has not been addressed. And I would strongly recommend all of you who are listening to have a look on the British in Europe website, which is really, really useful in terms of information. We are not a campaign group. We are researchers. And our job is to make sure that we represent thematically the diversity of populations. The campaign groups, their job is to campaign on you guys' behalf, and they have some really useful information. And if you have a look on the British in Europe website and where does the March agreement leave me, that's a publication you can find. It's the one web page, quite nice and quick and short. And it really is reassuring for a lot of issues. I think one of the things you were saying that you were concerned about was health, and I'll very gladly read to you what it says there. But in terms of continuing freedom of movement, they say here that this has not been resolved. So it remains something that they're really concerned. Sorry,
Yeah, we're obviously not particularly concerned about freedom of movement as like tourism. We may well have to do this new, like the ESTA for the United States, the visa waiver program electronically online, and do that and pay a one-off fee that's valid, the US one, I think it's 2 years, is it, or something. But you know, everybody would want our money, of course, as tourists. But we're talking about more the sort of the residential status. You mentioned the healthcare issue, and of course, the concern is that if you're going on holiday to Thailand for 2 weeks, then take out 2 weeks health insurance. That's fine. That's one thing for 2 weeks. But constant private health cover, particularly for many of our listeners who are, you know, beyond or approaching retirement age, and where one tends to things start to fall apart more often, then the absence of you know, the blue card if you're a tourist, or the local health cover in Spain is a serious issue.
So if I read to you what they've got written here, so it says reciprocal health care is agreed, so that those who have an S1 or will be eligible one for when they retire will still have their healthcare funded. And then it says, for these people, this includes a UK-issued EHIC. That's what used to be the
E111,
which will cover travel across the EU27, and we believe to the UK. This means that those who pay into the national system in their country of residence, for example, a British person working in Germany, the rules will also remain the same as they are now. You know, I mean, the thing is that what I find is that these things are all worded by lawyers. and they're done, obviously, to make sure that they're being very, very careful how they word things. And it still leaves us feeling somewhat nervous, doesn't it?
They don't know, do they? If the British government can't even agree with itself, you know, it's often said they're not negotiating with Europe, they're negotiating among themselves in the cabinet, let alone the Conservative Party. The Labour Party, I mean, they seem to be, you know, pretty split as well. I think it's 44% of the Labour peers in the House of Lords in the last vote alone voted against the official Labour Party position. So, yeah, I suppose that, you know, we hear sometimes think, right, that's ticked off, we're all agreed on that particular issue, that we move on to something else. And then intermittently we hear this phrase, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And so we're back to square one, aren't we?
And it's true. And what's really interesting to us, because obviously we're sociologists and we're interested in the more sort of human life story issues around this, is, you know, what it's doing for how people feel about their communities, where they live, where they feel at home, where they feel settled, how they feel about their futures. Because, you know, citizens' rights is one issue, and citizens' rights is what everyone's talking about, but citizens' rights doesn't encompass how people feel, how people get through the day. I mean, you know, we're talking to people who are having to make decisions about their futures because they're anxious now. So for example, there's a guy who's just been diagnosed with a limiting long-term illness, who's living in rural Spain, who speaks fluent Spanish, and to all intents and purposes is very settled. But he can't sit back and wait and decide, well, I'll see if things will be okay in the end. He needs to make decisions now. And he's ill. So these decisions are very difficult for him to make. They're very emotional decisions for people to make. And, you know, this is what we want to try to get across, that this is a very painful process for a lot of people to go through. And I understand that a lot of people listening will also be, you know, will have voted to leave or will have wanted to vote to leave. And we would love to hear more from those people about how they are feeling and whether they're finding the, you know, transition more easy to cope with or how, you know, how things affect them. But this is what we're concerned about, is, you know, people, how they feel about the community, how they feel about their home, how they feel about, you know, where they feel they belong. Anxiety about, especially in Spain, do I get Spanish citizenship? And if, you know, would that resolve everything? But then I can't also have British citizenship.
You mentioned the guy who lives in rural Spain, who you say speaks fluent Spanish. In his case, if he's lived in Spain for 10 years, if you're from a former Spanish colony, it's only 2 years. But 10 years in Spain to be able to apply for citizenship, you need to pass a Spanish test and you need a bit of culture. And it's multiple choice. It's not too difficult, as we said. So he would always have that option. I'll give our listeners your website. This the BrexitBrits.com, that one?
BrexitBritsAbroad.com.
So, I'm not talking to you now, Karen. I'm talking to you, the listener. note that down, BrexitBritsAbroad.com. And if you've got a particular story you'd like to tell Karen and her fellow researchers on this, and your story may bring out an emotional response in Jacob Rees-Mogg, who knows, and we can turn this whole thing around. I tell you on that front, Karen, that I predict how I will feel at midnight on the 29th of March next year. I think I'll feel pretty sad, actually, that, I'm no longer a European Union citizen.
One thing that's really coming out strongly in the research is that whether you are a Leave voter or a Remain voter or not sure either way, it's very emotional.
And I suppose one thing, which I'll put to our next guest as well, maybe, but because she's an avid campaigner, you may have heard of, she's known as EU Supergirl. She goes by, she dresses up as a superhero, goes around trying to campaign on these things. But is like some other things, you could say, you know, some global issues, that if people have voted or decided one way for emotional reasons, to counter that with logic and argument, rational discourse, is never going to work, because that wasn't used to form their opinion in the first place. I interviewed some people before the referendum, not long before, about a month or a couple of weeks before the referendum, some vox pops, so in the street on the Costa Blanca in Spain. I was speaking to people, and I didn't know what nationality they were. I thought, if they've got uncoordinated colours on their clothes, they're probably British. I was wrong, because the Dutch and German also do that. Certainly not many people from Milan, you might say. But on the whole, the Brits that I spoke to, I would say it was about 70-30 of the ones, I was amazed, that said that Brexit was a good idea. And they were in Spain. And 100% of all the other nationalities I spoke to, there were many there, they all thought it was a bad idea. So, yes,
right, shooting ourselves in the foot,
perhaps.
Yeah.
We're going to have to leave it there for today, Karen. But hopefully we can have another chat at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Excellent. And as you said, anyone who's got a story to tell us, especially if they think that they're somewhat different to the usual story, be grateful to hear from you.
Excellent. That website for our listeners to get in touch is BrexitBritsAbroad.com. Professor Karen O'Reilly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk Radio Europe.